Well, last night, if you were here, we had a pretty rapid survey of about a century of church history, a little less than that. The events leading up to the meeting of the Westminster Assembly, the background for that, both in the Puritan movement in England and the covenanting movement in Scotland, which culminated in the meeting of the Westminster Assembly. This morning I want to talk about the Assembly, it's the operation of the Assembly itself, its members, its procedures, and then we will look at the documents which the Assembly produced in its 5 years of work. As I said last night, the assembly began to meet July 1st, 1643. It's a little hard to give a closing date for the assembly. It finished its work substantially in 1648, 5 years of work, but some members of the assembly continued to meet after that to examine candidates for the ministry. They didn't have a fully established operating church government, and the records of those continuing meetings are not very complete, so it's hard to say exactly when the Westminster Assembly finished meeting together, but substantially 1643 to 1648. We'll talk first about the members of the assembly, and in the notes I call your attention to a recent book published by Will Barker, who was at Westminster Seminary in Philadelphia, among other places, and he's written a very nice book of short biographies of many of the members of the Westminster Assembly and some other Puritans from the same era, and it's very easy reading, and if you would like to pursue further knowledge of some of the people who met, Will Barker's book is a good one to read. I think it's maybe published by Mentor Press from out of Scotland. Well, I made the point last night that the Westminster Assembly was not a regular ecclesiastical body. It was rather an advisory commission for the English Parliament in the time of civil war. And that being the case, the Parliament decided who the members of the Assembly would be. They were not selected by presbyteries. There were no presbyteries in England, nor were they chosen by local congregations, but they were chosen by the Parliament. And in the ordinance which called the assembly, there were 121 ministers who were named as members of the assembly. And later on, 18 other ministers were appointed to serve. One of the things when you read this history that you begin to realize is the impact on our lives of modern medicine. And of course, in the 17th century, they didn't have that. And so there were a number of deaths of members of the assembly while the assembly was meeting, including William Twiss, who was the first moderator or prolocutor of the assembly. And in the minutes of the assembly, from time to time, there will be notices of members of the assembly going to visit men from the assembly who were ill or attending funerals. So as some died, others were appointed to take their place. Also, the ordinance named 20 members of the House of Commons and 10 members of the House of Lords to participate in the assembly. Contrary to what you might expect, these men were not ruling elders. There had not historically been any elders in the Church of England. And so these were rather representatives of the parliament who participated in the debates, and they would bring to the assembly the point of view of the parliament, and they would also be a vehicle for communication with the House of Commons and the House of Lords. It's interesting in the descriptions of the meeting of the assembly, they met in a relatively small room in Westminster Abbey called the Jerusalem Chamber. And Robert Bailey, who was a Scottish commissioner to the assembly, gives a very vivid description of the meeting of the assembly. And they were seated on tiered benches around that room, but the part of the room closest to the fireplace was occupied by the members of the House of Lords. And in cold weather, they were allowed to keep their hats on and others were not. So rank has its privileges. And that was true even in the meeting of the Westminster Assembly. The House of Lords, the members from the House of Lords got the best seats in the House. Another interesting feature of the seating was that the Scottish commissioners, who were not voting members, had a seat on the lowest level in the assembly, but closest to the moderator, closest to the prolocutor. And that's kind of symbolic of their role in the assembly. Didn't have voting power, but did have significant influence in the work of the assembly. Now, of those who were named, 30 members, 30 ministers and 10 members of the of Parliament never attended. The reason for that was that after the assembly was called to meet, King Charles issued a decree forbidding those who were named in the ordinance to participate. And some of those who were named obeyed the king and did not take place in the assembly. Probably the most outstanding among those was Archbishop James Usher from Ireland, who was actually named to be a part of the assembly, but who obeyed the king and did not attend. And that's particularly interesting because Usher had written earlier in the century the so-called Irish Articles of Religion. That was a brief confession of faith, which probably influenced the assembly and its drawing up of the Confession of Faith. So they appreciated Usher's theological work, but Usher was obedient to the king and did not attend the assembly. As time went on, the attendance at the assembly dwindled until the fact, when they had votes recorded, the numbers of those voting range from 40 to 60. So probably a more manageable group than if they had had the full 120 ministers and 30 members of parliament who were there. All of the ministers who participated in the assembly were reformed in theology. When the Reformation first took place in England, there was some influence on the, for example, the 39 Articles from a Lutheran perspective. But as time went on, more and more the theological stance of the Church of England was Calvinistic or Reformed, and particularly with regard to the doctrine of God and the doctrine of salvation, that Reformed perspective is found in the 39 Articles, not so much in the doctrine of the sacraments, for example. But they did not have deep disagreements in matters of basic theology. There were some details that they had discussion of, but in general they were all Calvinistic or Reformed in their theology. To go beyond that for a moment, none of them were Baptists. They all believed in infant baptism and didn't have serious discussion of that. It hardly came up in the assembly. And all of them were episcopally ordained. They'd all been ordained by bishops. There was a question last night about separatists, and none of the separatists were in the assembly. And that's probably explained by the fact that they were chosen by members of parliament. So all of them had received ordination from bishops, with the exception of the Scottish commissioner, George Gillespie, who was quite young, in his 20s, and was one of the first two men to be ordained in Scotland after 1638, when they no longer had bishops and had presbyteries that could do the ordination. And so, as I've said, they were also all non-separatists. So that you could say, in a sense, that the more radical Puritans were not represented in the assembly. They were the folks who had pulled out of the Church of England, were suffering persecution, had gone often either to the Netherlands or to New England. And so even the independents who were in the assembly were people who had performed their ministry within the bounds of the Church of England. It's pretty common in the histories of the Westminster Assembly to talk about the parties in the assembly, and I'm going to do that. It's a convenient way to talk about the makeup of the assembly, but we ought to not to make too much of the word party. In our Congress, for example, they have caucuses. They have the Black Caucus, and of course the Democrats have a caucus, and the Republicans have a caucus. These groups were not that clearly defined. They were sort of loose coalitions of people that had similar views, and it's possible to identify them, but they would not be voting as a block on every issue, but it is possible to identify these groupings. There were named in the ordinance a number of Episcopalians. I've already mentioned Archbishop Usher of the Church of Ireland, and there were two other bishops who were named in the ordinance, and between 8 and 20 others who could be identified as Episcopalians, and all of them except one obeyed the king's order and did not attend. So briefly, there was one Episcopalian in the assembly, a man by the name of Daniel Featley, and he got into trouble for questioning the validity of the Solemn League and Covenant, and was soon, by vote of the assembly, voted out, and so he did not continue to participate. And so from an objective standpoint, you can say the Episcopal point of view was not effectively represented in the discussions of the assembly. Then there were three men pretty clearly identified as Erastians, and let me take a moment to explain the meaning of that term. The term comes from the name of a German Reformed theologian by the name of Thomas Erastus, but as the term was commonly used, it didn't always have reference to his, specifically to his fully developed views, but what he had advocated was the fact that the church was under the authority of the civil magistrate, and that particularly in the realm of discipline, the civil magistrate would have the final say. So as I've quoted in the notes, Erastianism is the view that disciplinary power and ultimately all church power rested in the civil magistrate. And so if you had a flowchart of authority for the Church of England, the king and or the parliament, and while the assembly's meeting, it's the parliament, is above the courts of the church and can give direction to the church and can veto actions taken by the church. I believe that is still the case in England, that the queen has the ultimate power, and that, for example, the confession of the Church of England could not be changed without the approval of Parliament. So you have the interesting situation of heir to the throne, Charles, who is in violation of the law of the Church of England because of his divorce. But should he become king, he will be the head of the Church of England. And so that's a kind of catch-22 situation that exists there. Very foreign to Americans in the 21st century, but this was the view of the Erastians. And if you think about the way in which the assembly was organized, it's under the parliament. And so there's a sense in which this is an Erastian situation. The parliament sets the agenda of the assembly. The assembly presents its work to the parliament under the title, The Humble Advice of the Assembly of Divines. And then the parliament either agrees and it becomes law in England, or the parliament disagrees and it becomes a historical document that has no practical effect. There were only three members of the assembly that were clearly identified as Erastians, but they had a good bit of influence because, as you can imagine, there would be a tendency in the parliament to want to be in control. People in power like to retain power and often enhance their power, and so there would be a natural tendency in that direction. There was a very famous debate on this subject in the assembly between John Selden, who was a lawyer and a member of parliament, very highly regarded as a legal scholar in England, and he had a debate with young George Gillespie. The particular point of the debate was whether in the Old Testament there was a distinction between civil authority and ecclesiastical authority. And Selden argued that there was no significant distinction, and that basically the government of Israel was Erastian, the religious aspects of the life of Israel under the authority of the king. And George Gillespie argued the opposite, and the general conclusion made by the people who were there present and by historians since is that George Gillespie won the argument and defeated this great legal scholar in debate. And the report is, as this is recounted, that as Selden was speaking in the assembly, presenting his case, that George Gillespie was seen writing in his notebook. And then after Selden finished, George Gillespie rose and, without consulting his notes, gave an extensive answer, point by point, of what Selden had said. And then when people had a chance to see what was in the notebook, they saw that Gillespie had written over and over again, "Lord, give light. Lord, give light." Well, that's quite an exciting story. It almost suggests that George Gillespie was inspired in his ability to defeat Selden, but the reality of the fact is not quite the same. Number one, Gillespie did not speak until the next day. So he had overnight to reflect on what Selden had said and then respond to it. And secondly, George Gillespie was in the process, if he had not completed it, of writing a whole book in answer to Selden. And they had both, Selden had published his views, so this wasn't something just new in the debates. And I mentioned that not to take delight in debunking popular history, but because what it suggests is that you don't need to really do your homework. You don't really need to work. You just sort of trust the Lord to help you in the moment. I remember in my early days in Synod, and I don't know whether at that time I was conscious of this story or not, but I had the idea that what's done in Synod in the discussions there needs to be spontaneous, and that it was sort of cheating to carefully work out ahead of time what you might say in discussions of Synod. And I think that view led for me and for others of saying some fairly foolish things in the discussions in Synod. And so I think we trust the Lord to give us light, but we also do our work, and he can guide us while we're making preparations as well as later. There's a story that I used to tell in homiletics classes at seminary. I think it came from John Stott, if I can give credit for it. But there was a minister in the Church of England who never made preparation for preaching, and he simply depended upon the leading of the Holy Spirit in the moment. I've had some students like that at seminary from time to time. And one day he heard that his bishop was coming to visit. And so he was a bit worried about how it would go, and he wasn't able to talk to the bishop ahead of time, but he left him a note that said, "I have taken a vow before the Lord not to make preparation ahead of time, but simply to depend on the Holy Spirit." And at the end of the service, the bishop went out hurriedly, didn't speak to him, but left a note for him, and the note said, "I absolve you from your vow." He didn't think that the outcome was very spiritual. So I think that's kind of a practical lesson that comes from an often repeated story that's a really good story but is not quite historically accurate. Well, then there was a small but very influential group in the assembly made up of people who were called independents. We would say in more modern terms, Congregationalists, like the folks that settled in New England. They didn't like the name independent. It was a nickname that was given to them. But they were characterized by the view that people were free to choose what church they would worship in, and also that all church authority was in the local congregation. On the first point, the church in England was made up of parishes that were geographical divisions. And so if you lived within a certain geographical area, then you had the parish church, which you were required by law to attend. And so the congregation was established by geographical boundaries. The independents, who were more radical than many others, wanted to avoid that kind of regulation, and they said, in my parish church, there may be a lukewarm pastor, he may not even be converted, and there's a godly preacher in a neighboring parish that is really preaching the gospel. I will go and I will worship in that other church, not in my parish church. So this was a kind of religious freedom that was not generally the case in England in this period of time. And it's come to be certainly in America, and it would also be true among the dissenting churches now in England that we follow the pattern of the independents. We are really a gathered church rather than a parish church. And you could talk about pluses and minuses connected with that, but that's the situation. With regard to church authority, the independents thought that all the authority that a church needed was in the local body. Power of ordination, the power of discipline, the governing of worship, and so forth. They were willing and in fact desired a consultation with representatives of other churches, but they did not need that consultation. They could decide all matters on their own. And increasingly, I think in our country, as independent Bible churches have grown, and it's true also, of course, in Baptist and congregational circles, it's the congregational form of church government that is perhaps characteristically American in these days. The most prominent independents were, and these are names you may recognize if you know about the reprints of Puritan literature, Thomas Goodwin, Jeremiah Burroughs, Philip Nye, William Bridge. And there were three or four others, again, not in lockstep with one another, but clearly identified grouping. Perhaps a majority in the assembly were pragmatic Presbyterians. That is, men who believe that Presbyterianism, at least in their present circumstances, was the best kind of church government, worked best, and therefore they were in favor of it, but they did not believe in Presbyterian church government on principle. And so after the time of the Westminster Assembly, when the Church of England was again under the rule of bishops, many of these were willing to be a part of that. In fact, some of them became bishops. Well, Edward Reynolds, at least, who was quite a prominent member of the Westminster Assembly, actually became a bishop later on. Presbyterianism, I shouldn't assume knowledge of that. The basic principle of Presbyterianism is that decisions are made not by the congregation as a whole and not by the pastor or a single bishop, but church decisions are made by a plurality of elders in the local congregation and beyond. And then there are courts of the church, assemblies of ministers and elders beyond the local congregation, which have the power to make authoritative decisions which are binding upon the local congregation. That becomes most obvious in a Presbyterian system in the matter of ordination, which is in the hands not of the local congregation, but of the presbytery. And then there were other Presbyterians that are called divine right Presbyterians, and these are those who believed that Presbyterian church government was the biblical pattern for church government. And so you'll find, for example, in the document which the assembly produced called the Form of Presbyterial Church Government, there's an extensive biblical argument for governing of the church by elders chosen by the people and for the authority of courts or assemblies of elders beyond the local congregation to make decisions with regard to the church. The Scottish commissioners were to a man divine right Presbyterians. Samuel Rutherford had written a book called The Due Right of Presbytery, which was a strong argument for a biblical argument for Presbyterian church government. And there were many allies among the English in the assembly. So a majority of the assembly, it turns out, were either pragmatic or principled Presbyterians. Given that broad agreement, these folks still had some disagreements about some of the other officers. They had a clear understanding of what the work of a minister or a pastor was, but about the other officers, they didn't have necessarily a common understanding. When I come to talk about the form of Presbyterial church government, I'll have a bit more to say about that. Well, let me talk about the rules and procedures of the assembly. In the ordinance, the parliament had named the prolocutor or moderator, a man by the name of William Twiss, and also the scribes. Robert Bailey, the Scottish commissioner, interestingly, was a man who never spoke in the assembly. There's no record of his ever making a speech in the debates of the assembly. But what he did was to spend a lot of time writing letters to friends all over the place reporting what was going on in the assembly. So the letters and journals of Robert Bailey are a really important source for the history of the assembly. But Bailey was kind of a suspicious guy, and he wrote to somebody about William Twiss, the moderator, is that the Parliament had on purpose named a man who was not a strong moderator so that the Parliament would have more opportunity to control what went on in the assembly. So Twiss was a respected theologian, but not a very good moderator. In fact, it turns out, as you read the minutes of the assembly, that the real leader of the assembly was a man by the name of Cornelius Burgess, who often represented the assembly when they presented something to Parliament. And he had the title of an assistant to the moderator, but Twiss was often ill, in fact died, as I said, during the assembly. And so Cornelius Burgess or another man by the name of John White would often be the ones who actually presided. The naming of the clerks is interesting. Adoniram Byfield was the main clerk, and I have seen photocopies of his handwritten minutes, and they are virtually indecipherable. He had terrible handwriting. It was like a doctor writing a prescription. In fact, the published minutes, and I just learned that Stillwater Revival Books has reprinted now the published minutes. The published minutes don't cover the first year of the assembly. I had to work with those on microfilm, but the published minutes were done by a cryptographer from the British Museum by the name of John Struthers, and his work was to decipher ancient writings, and so he was enlisted to make a transcript of Adoniram Byfield's minutes of the assembly. So why the Parliament chose a man whose handwriting could not be read is hard to figure out. Each member of the assembly took an oath that he would be guided by the scriptures. Most historians, including Hetherington, say every Monday morning the members of the assembly took this oath. Hetherington thought that the original minutes had been lost, and so he didn't have access to them. According to the minutes, it turns out that this was not the case, that they took the oath every week. They took the oath entering when they first were seated as members of the assembly. There was a period later on in which they weren't getting along very well. There was a lot of delay. There was a lot of frustration. And the assembly passed an order saying, from now on, every Monday morning, we're going to take this oath. But according to the minutes, it soon kind of died out and they didn't keep doing it. The positive thing is that they were really serious in the work that they were doing. They were oath-bound to maintain in the assembly only that which they believed was according to the Word of God. And so they were very serious about what they were doing. And any member who disagreed with the decision of the assembly could have his dissent recorded and also the reasons for it. I'm involved these days in reading through minutes of synod. I don't know if it will work out, but the history of the RP Church in this country has not been written in any detail since 1871. And so if the Lord spares me and gives me the ability to write, I may try to do something along that line. But as you read the minutes of synod, lots of things are routine. But you know when there is a really controversial issue, when somebody calls for a roll call vote, and then you have the recording of the ayes and the noes, the names of the people, and then typically when you have that kind of a vote, you will have recording of dissent, and then the synod appoints a committee to answer the reasons for the dissent. And that comes into this congregation in 1891, in which the pastor, a man by the name of Milligan, was connected with a questioning of the position of political dissent in the church, which led to a trial in Pittsburgh and led to about 20 ministers and about 1,000 members leaving the denomination. But in those 1891 minutes, there are a number of roll call votes and recording of dissents and reasons for dissent and answer to the reasons. That's an important safeguard for minority viewpoints in the deliberations of the courts of the church. But it had a special point at this time. They were, as I told you last night, in the midst of civil war. What happens if you lose, you're on the losing side of the civil war? In the 17th century, if you lose a political battle, let alone a war, you are likely to lose your life. You don't just get impeached or voted out, you get accused of treason and get executed. And so among the members of the assembly later on, Samuel Rutherford and Archibald Johnston, Scottish commissioners, were tried and accused of treason. And Rutherford would have been executed, but he didn't live long enough for that to happen. And Archibald Johnston actually was executed for his participation in the events that we are talking about. So one of the points of this recording of dissent was, if later on you were called to account for actions of the assembly, you would be able to say to the authorities, I didn't agree with that. I have my dissent from it recorded in writing. And whether the tyrannical courts would listen to that or not. At least it was a clear defense against being associated with the assembly and with positions that it might take. Decisions were made by a majority vote, and there was no limit on debate in the assembly. And that became, for many of the people, a great frustration. That was one of the rules set down by the parliament, no limit on debate. And so you often find in the minutes complaints about the length of the debates. And Thomas Goodwin, the leader of the independents, I once did a tabulation, I don't remember now what led me to do this, about who spoke most often in the assembly in the first year of its work. And Thomas Goodwin led the list. He spoke much more often than anybody else. But he made the comment once in the assembly when they were discussing the fact that they were going on too long and they weren't coming to decisions. Thomas Goodwin had the grace to say, "If we studied more, we would talk less," which is a good principle. If we studied more, we would talk less. He studied a lot, but he also talked a lot. The fact of the matter was that the independents sensed that the assembly was going to approve Presbyterian church government. They didn't want to see that happen. Cromwell was rising to power politically and militarily, and the independents staged a kind of filibuster in the assembly to delay things until the circumstances outside the assembly would change and they would not be forced to be under a national Presbyterian church government. But undoubtedly, the debates were long, and not all of that was profitable or necessary. The assembly generally met 5 days a week, from 9 or 10 in the morning until about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And then when that was done, they would often have committee meetings. I haven't put in the notes about committees, but they did a lot of their work by committees. The whole assembly was divided into three general committees. And so, for example, when they worked on the Confession of Faith, there was first a small drafting committee that would come up with a basic statement of on a certain topic of doctrine. Then that work of that committee would go to one of the three general committees for review. Then it would come to the full assembly for debate. And after the assembly had made decisions, then it would go to an editing committee that would clean it up and restate it if necessary. And so through this committee work, there was very careful attention given to the exact wording of the Confession of Faith. I give you on that page a calendar of the work of the assembly, you can see there the length of time that was spent on the various documents of the assembly. More than a year at the beginning of the assembly on church government. And probably there was the greatest disagreement there. On other things, they worked more swiftly. But I'm going to talk about the various documents, so I'll not do more about that calendar just now. I'm not sure, James, if this will fit in, but before I go to the documents, maybe this would be appropriate place to stop and give opportunity for questions. Yes. Yes, the question is why it was called the Westminster Assembly. Well, it's called an assembly because it's a meeting or a gathering of these ministers and members of parliament appointed by the parliament itself. It's called the Westminster Assembly because it met in Westminster Abbey. And so that's a kind of nickname. I think they would say, this is the humble advice of the Assembly of Divines meeting at Westminster. So the name Westminster comes from Westminster Abbey. And the name Westminster itself would be the West Monastery. So we were told a story when we were there. Technically, the name of Westminster Abbey is the Cathedral of St. Peter. And you may know also that there is in London St. Paul's Cathedral. And Westminster is the older building. A tour guide in London told us this, is the older building. And when St. Paul's was being built, they took funds that somehow had been designated for St. Peter's, Westminster Abbey, and gave them for the building of St. Paul's Cathedral. And so that was robbing Peter to pay Paul. Any other questions? Yes.
Is there one over here? Okay, we'll go over here first. What role did the German Confessions Intelligence Institutes have on influencing the way the Westminster Confession?
Okay. The question is, what influence did the German Confessions and Calvin's Institutes have on the Westminster Confession? I will talk about that more when I come to talk about the confession itself, but in a preliminary way, let me say the Westminster Confession is the last, historically, of all of the Reformed confessions. And they were aware of, conscious of, interacting with all of that body of confessional language in the work that they were doing. They sometimes a popular understanding of the assembly was they had made this oath, we will not maintain anything in our deliberations but what is according to the Word of God. And sometimes the impression is that they simply started from scratch and opened their Bibles and made a summary of what they found in the Bible. That's not the way it worked. They were aware of a whole history of confessional statements and interacted with those, incorporated part of what was there, departed in some instance from what was there. But it's very much a continuum between the earlier confessions and what is in Westminster. The question is, did they have a quorum? And I think not. Yeah, they had trouble with attendance as this went on 5 years. You know, some members of Synod might long for that, but I don't myself to be in a meeting for 5 years. For example, Samuel Rutherford had a child born back home in Scotland. He's 400 miles away, and he's not allowed to go home. He has to stay there and do this work. So they didn't establish a quorum, but as I've said, the voting records indicate 40 to 60 usually did the work. Yes.
So, were they all in the Church of England, ordained by some minister?
All of these ministers, they were non-separatists, and so this I'm thinking of a modern parallel. Some of you may know about John Gerstner, and John Gerstner was a minister and professor in the PCUSA. And stayed in the PCUSA for a long time, though he was a strong Calvinist and very critical of developments in the church and so on. But John Gerstner was a non-separatist. He was kind of in the tradition of these people, staying in a church with which they had some serious disagreement. That's always a tough question to decide. When comes the point where you ought to leave a church that is unfaithful in significant ways? Calvin, incidentally, in the Institutes, has advice in that way, really warning against leaving too quickly. So Dr. Gerstner stayed in that church for a long time. He finally did make the step of leaving, and then pretty quickly, when he had made the decision, began to say other people ought to leave as well. But these folks were non-separatists.
Dr. Spear, I just had one question with respect to the independents or Congregationalists. Here in the U.S., we have a lot of different expressions of this. There may be some independent churches that operate like a mini papacy with one powerful pastor, or they might be in some ways more congregational, ruled by elders, but all of the power being contained within the local church. Or in other cases, they're very democratic, maybe no pastor, maybe no elders at all. It's sort of a council of whoever shows up. What sort of practical church government would these independents have exercised or desired to exercise?
That's a very good observation. These various groups would be united in that all authority rests in the local congregation, but it could take a different form. In fact, one of the charges that were made by the non-Puritans is, you folks aim to have a pope in every parish, and congregational church government can take that form with a very strong pastoral leadership. I'm thinking of a book on the Baptist deacon by W.A. Criswell, who had a 20,000-member church in Dallas. And basically, he says in this book, the task of the deacon is to support and help the pastor in whatever he wants to do. So it's rule by the pastor with assistance from others. And in fact, in a lot of church growth literature, that position is advocated. You got to have a strong CEO if you're going to have a growing church. For the independents, and this later worked out in New England, we might call them Congregational Presbyterians, if that's not too confusing to you, because they believed in a plurality of elders joining with the pastor in the local congregation to exercise authority, but did not, except for the choice of officers, did not advocate the membership broadly making the decisions. But they did, unlike the Presbyterians, they did believe that all jurisdiction rested in the local congregation, quite willing to consult more broadly with elders from other congregations, but not to allow that broader group to make authoritative decisions. The question is whether the version of the Bible they used was the King James, the Authorized Version, or the Geneva Bible. I don't know precisely the answer to that. My impression is they used the King James Bible. And I should go back to that a minute. You remember I said last night that coming south from Scotland, James was confronted by a group of Puritan ministers who asked him to do a number of things, including a request for a new translation of the Bible. He turned down all of their requests except that one, and that led to the production of the King James Bible. So from James's standpoint, this was a somewhat political move to conciliate the Puritans. But it's an example of the Lord using something less than ideal, namely in James's motivation, to produce a really good thing. And the King James translation was a really good translation. I'm not aware of having read in any of the minutes anything that identifies whether they did that rather than the Geneva Bible. Geneva Bible, by the way, was done for those English exiles during the reign of Mary who were living in Geneva, and so it was an English translation produced for them.